Hi, everybody. Thank you for joining us on this podcast about crypto. My name is Alison Donnelly. I'm a payments regulation specialist and a director of the boutique compliance consultancy FS.com. That's my day job, but by volunteer, I work as the project lead on Project Regulator, one of the EPA's very important projects that brings together policy and compliance leads to give voice to the community's aspirations for a sound regulatory framework that protects consumers' interests by walking the tightrope of balancing consumer protection obligations with the ability for smart and entrepreneurial people to bring together something new and hopefully even better to consumers. Crypto is one of those areas of innovation that is full of the possibility, but also jargon and complexity and new stuff that just makes it quite difficult to see the tightrope, never mind actually balancing on it. On our panel today, we have leading EPA and project regulator members who have important insight and comments to make on crypto. I will let them introduce themselves and tell us why they are interested in crypto. But before I do, I'll make the important disclaimer that while each panelist will tell us where they currently work, their contribution reflects their personal view and not necessarily the view of their employer. Max, can I turn to you to introduce yourself first, please?
Absolutely. Thanks, Alison, and thanks for having me on the podcast. Hope to live up to the bill on that. I'm a partner at the law firm Sidley Austin. I focus on payments and fintech regulation, particularly in the UK and the EU, and I advise a number of firms on some of the areas we'll be discussing today.
Thank you, Max. Stephen.
Thanks, Alison. My name is Stephen Marshall. I'm the Chief Product and Network Officer at Crown Agents Bank. We specialise in emerging and frontier market foreign exchange and payments, and clearly deal with a lot of fintechs around the world. Crypto clearly is a topic of hot discussion with many of them.
Thank you, Stephen. And Mitch.
Thanks, Alison. Hi, everyone. My name is Mitch Trahan. I've been working in financial services for 19 years in various forms of risk and compliance across Barclays, Citi, JP Morgan. And I'm currently the UK head of compliance and MLRO at Banking Circle. Banking Circle provides services to banks and non-bank PSPs. And I've become really interested in the crypto space recently, simply because if you think over the last few years, more and more seems to be happening in a very short space of time now. It's been around for a while, but people are now really starting to stand up, take notice, more regulatory requirements, and it's just an exciting space at the moment.
Thank you, everybody. You're right, it's absolutely an exciting space. There's plenty of places to start, but we're going to start with my first question being on the AML registration. The FCA has had to extend the temporary regime again, which really just doesn't sound like good news. What do we know about the quality of the applications and the FCA's expectations? Max, can I turn to you first?
Of course. Well, I think on this one, I think it's probably worth starting with what this regime's about and also what it isn't about. So this is what we're talking about here is a specific registration for AML anti-money laundering supervision under the UK money laundering regulations. It's not part of the broader authorization regime for regulatory activities or financial promotions, which hopefully we'll come on to later. And these UK AML requirements, these have been extended to apply to two types of firms that weren't previously within the regime. Firstly, crypto asset exchange providers, which are firms that are involved in exchanging money and crypto assets and vice versa, and custodian wallet providers, which safeguard those crypto assets, all the private keys, you know, linked to those crypto assets for their owners. Now, firms that carry on those activities in the UK are now subject to various requirements relating to AML, anti-money laundering. And that includes what we're talking about now, which is registering with the FCA. And that's not just a notification or a tick box. That is an application process. The regime also covers a whole load of requirements on customer due diligence, reporting, monitoring of transactions, disclosures, AML risk management and governance, and record keeping. And As part of the registration, firms need to be able to convince the FCA that they're going to be able to comply with all of those broader requirements under the regime. And I think that's where the issue lies here. So the FCA has, you know, received a number of these applications, and it's said that a significantly high number of businesses are not meeting the required standards. So it's basically gone and told a load of firms they have to redo their homework. And because of this, the FCA has extended, you know, for a second time, it's extended its deadline for firms to get registered, in this case, from what was going to be the 9th of July to the 31st of March next year, 2022. And I think the takeaway for firms in this space is that, you know, the FCA takes these requirements very seriously. You need to understand what the broader AML compliance framework means if you fall within scope of it. And the FCA is not going to be an easy marker. And just one other point to make on this is, you know, these requirements come from an EU directive. They come from the money laundering directive in its latest form. And so these kinds of rules apply generally across the European economic area. But your FCA registration is only good for the UK. So if you're a firm that's operating in this space with customers in the UK and the EU EEA, you might be looking at double or even multiple registration requirements. And you're probably going to have to look at different local rules.
Mitch.
Thanks, Alison. Thanks, Max. Yeah, completely agree with everything Max is saying. And what's super key is if you read the notification that came out from the FCA, they're explicitly saying now, and I'll quote it, a significantly high number of businesses are not meeting the required standards under the money laundering regulations. And this has resulted in an unprecedented number of businesses withdrawing their applications. So what we can see just from online data is there's around 70 to 80 businesses that are currently part of the temporary registration regime. And if we look at those that have actually successfully become fully registered, there's currently only six. And then you get that release coming out from the FCA. So it does, you know, create a dynamic of A, the FCA is taking this seriously, as Max alluded to. But B, what's going to happen to those 80-odd firms on that register? What are we going to be left with? I mean, this is crystal ball gazing at this point. I have no idea. But the proportions at this stage do seem quite unbalanced.
And will those firms have to, if they have to withdraw, of course, they have to shut down their business, Mitch or Max?
I guess just before I hand over to another of the colleagues, it all depends what is their full business model. So if you go through those that are registering, some have obviously been created just for this crypto piece. Others are actually existing e-money institutions or institutions that want this additional piece. And that in itself creates questions, because if the FCA is saying you're already supervised, you're already licensed, you're already authorized as an e-money firm, but now you're trying to also get this registration and we're not happy, what does that mean for that bigger picture? So, Alison, to answer your question, I guess it means what's the full business model of the applicant to know what's going to happen?
Stephen.
It's an interesting point, but I would, first of all, applaud the FCA. I think the stance they're taking is clearly a very firm one. And given there's a sort of patchwork quilt approach to regulation of not just the crypto world, but more broadly across the fintech world, across various regulators around the world, setting a high benchmark is important. I think given the explosion of fintech entities, especially in the UK, but of course more broadly around other markets as well. And too often I think there's been almost a registration, not regulation approach, in that it must be extremely challenging for regulators to keep on top of the activity of this huge number and expanding number of players. So presumably the FCA are taking a risk-based approach, and they're looking at the crypto world and saying, we want to have very tight regulation in this space. As you yourself and Max and Mitch have said, it clearly is a worrying sign that so many, a significant number have been asked to withdraw their applications, and difficult to predict what this means going forward. Other than, I think it's reassuring that our regulator in the UK is taking a very hard stance when it comes to ensuring governance of more broader AML concerns. So I think that alone is certainly cause for hope as we look forward with the cryptocurrency regulations.
And an interesting point there is that it's the UK's taken a very different approach to registering these firms than elsewhere. I certainly have some experience in Ireland, and there the central bank has very much focused on AML points, but in the application, whereas in the UK, the FCA's had asked for quite expansive amounts of information. They're asking about a lot of detail around IT controls and the more general enterprise-wide risk controls. Mitch, I think you also wanted to talk about the difference of approach.
So, indeed, the difference of approach across all the regulators has been very apparent. Not only discussing what the level of detail the FCA is going to, but what we're also seeing is the FCA has got this temporary registration regime and it's public. So you can see who's applying. And those that have passed and become on the register, you can also see those six firms. But if you go to different EEA countries, it's not necessarily the same competent authority that is the one that is responsible for this registration. So let's take Lithuania, for example. If you're to get licensed in Lithuania, the authorizing entity is the Bank of Lithuania. But if you want to be registered for crypto, it's through their FIU and their Financial Crime Investigation Service. And to date from the last view, we can't see who is or is not registered to know whether or not you can do business with them. Same for Estonia. The competent authority for this is simply the Estonian Police and Border Guard. And it's interesting when you compare this to the approach the UK has taken. There are a number of supervisors in the UK. You've also got HMRC as a supervising body for AML. But the UK has made the decision that it will be the FCA as the competent authority, and they will publicise and they will go through that level of investigation before saying someone suitable to go onto the register. And I find that super interesting. And if I can be completely honest about my own opinion, I actually think it's the right thing to do. There is a barrier to entry that the UK has created. And I know a lot of people are very upset about these barriers to entry. But working for a bank that has to provide services to clients, it gives banks comfort from a risk-based approach that actually the supervisory regime involved has taken this seriously, has mitigated the risks. And there's a lot to be said about that. I'll pause there to see if any of my colleagues have something to add.
And it's not just banks, because we know that there's, as you mentioned earlier, Mitch, there's a lot of e-money institutions that will work with crypto firms. And it strikes me that there's two things from this. There's the complication, as you're pointing out, about who those firms are associating with, and have they got sufficient controls in place? And from what we see with the application process, quite possibly they haven't been reaching the standard. And of course, for many years, they didn't have to reach the standard. But of course, the fifth money laundering directive came into effect a while back. So since then, they should have been meeting those requirements. But the other thing is the point you made earlier about the different jurisdictions and actually just knowing where they should be, where a firm should be registered. So you could be operating in the UK and be registered in the UK, but you could also be providing services to clients elsewhere. And there's no overriding regime that you can put passports. So you might have customers in, for sake of argument, France, but you have no base or physical establishment in France, do you have to be registered in France as well? And for an e-money institution or payment institution, or indeed a bank having to or looking to onboard and work with such clients, they'll need to be able to juggle that and understand what the obligations are on that firm.
Yeah, completely. You've covered it precisely. And it's also that lack of passporting, right? If you're in Lithuania, if you're in Estonia, or if you're in the UK, you're limited to those jurisdictions. And that's a key point.
And of course, the FCA has been quite proactive recently, and as have other regulators. And there's been plenty of warnings being issued. What do consumers and payments and e-money institutions, so consumers, payment and e-money institutions, and indeed, of course, banks, need to know and think about before getting involved with crypto businesses? Max.
Thanks, Alison. So I think it's important for firms to understand, you know, the broader regulatory landscape here. Certainly the AML points we've been talking about so far are very important. There's a lot of other things in this space that I think firms, you know, need to understand if they're looking to play in this market. So firstly, in the UK, we've got, you know, restrictions on the marketing and promotion of certain kinds of crypto assets, including an outright ban on marketing and sales of crypto asset derivatives and exchange traded notes to consumers. And then we've got regulatory authorization requirements that go beyond these AML registrations. And these currently apply to most forms of what the FCA calls e-money tokens. So tokens that fall within the definition of e-money under the e-money regulations, which some payment service providers will be familiar with. So just as a recap on those, or a you know, intro for people who don't know, that's stored monetary value representing a claim on the issuer, which is a big point in crypto because there isn't always an issuer. And the token isn't always a claim against the issuer. Redeemable at any time at par value, accepted by third parties and not excluded by something like the limited network exclusion, which is, you know, where the token's only used in a very limited, you know, set of providers, a range of circumstances. And then you've got authorization requirements, which, you know, again, currently apply. This isn't reformed, it's current law. If there's what the FCA calls security tokens, and those are tokens that fall within the scope of the Financial Services and Markets Act. So that includes financial instruments. That's things like shares, debt instruments, derivatives, units in funds and collective investment schemes. And the point, I think the broader point here is, you know, Mitch, I think, made this point earlier. It depends on the type of token, right, what's covered. And you need to think about that. Not all tokens are the same. There's different regulatory requirements here. If you fall within one of those regimes, not only do you have to be authorized, you're also subject to various conduct of business requirements, prudential requirements, things like safeguarding for e-money, client assets for other kinds of instruments and reporting, and all those AML rules we were talking about earlier will apply as well. So I think it's really important, you know, whenever a firm's getting involved in this scape, in this, you know, in this area, to think about, right, what are the use cases for this token? Which of those regimes could it fall within? Will it be exempt? And then I'll pause in a second, but the next point here is this is not static. You know, this regulation is changing. The UK government, the Treasury, has put out two consultation papers on this. It's looking to extend the scope of its regulatory perimeter, you know, particularly focusing on things like stable coins or stable tokens that aren't currently treated as e-money or financial instruments. I'll pause there.
Thanks, Max. That's brilliant. And it leads on to me to wonder, Steve, Mitch, you're both from banks, and like the FCA, perhaps, who's also had to very quickly, as with everybody, come to grips with a developing, evolving sector, understand and what where the risks are and who the key players are and what the key aspects are. Your employers will also have had to go on that journey, and it would be brilliant to understand what that journey has looked like for your respective organisations. Mitch, can we go to you first?
Yes, of course, no problem. And you're right, it is exactly that. It's a journey, and there's different stages and different learnings that we're all going on. So from Banking Circle's perspective, when we started reviewing, dipping our toe in, understanding, is this indeed a world that we want to start being involved with? There's a number of facets. And I think it's appropriate to call out that every bank that does multi-currency will also have a correspondent banking network and rely upon other banks where they are not a direct clearer. So what I'm saying here is where Banking Circle itself has direct access to a clearing scheme, we've got more control over our risk appetite and what we want to do. And we'll come to how we mitigate that risk in a second, and this is generally speaking, but were you reliant upon another bank to have access to the clearing systems, let's say you're reliant on another bank for dollars, you become subject to the risk appetite of that bank and whether that bank is willing to allow other banks beneath it to offer services to these types of firms. So that's a key part when discovering any appetite, whether you can or cannot go into a business. You've got to look at, where am I master of my own destiny? And where am I subject to one of my correspondent bank's rules? And then I'll hand over to Stephen shortly, because I think he'll have similar experiences and diverse experiences as well on this. But when we are indeed master of our own destiny from a risk appetite perspective, there's a number of key things that we do. And we're public on this. We put this on the websites as well. So we only want to work with virtual currency, crypto asset firms, et cetera, that are registered and authorized by the appropriate competent authorities in UK, EEA, equivalent jurisdictions that comply with the 5MLD or equivalent standards, and comply with the FATF recommendations on virtual currencies. But we go further than that. It's also looking at the experience of the members that are building this business, their senior management, their leadership team, the risk profile of these individuals, the MLRO, what do they know about this space and how long have they been doing this? What transaction monitoring tools do they have in place? How can they identify mixers, tumblers? What's deemed satisfactory? And we're breaking that down. How do they know the transaction and what KYT, know your transaction, methodologies are there in place? And we're going along that journey and breaking it down and understanding, right, which firms are taking this seriously and are mitigating these risks. And then building a relationship and learning more from that perspective. Stephen, I think maybe...
Yeah, thanks, Matt. I mean, we've certainly been on a journey. It's fair to say it's quite a short journey, in that, given the nature of our business, you know, we operate with a lot of fintech clients. Equally, we do provide banking services to commercial banks and central banks across many emerging and frontier markets. So, you know, the topic of cryptocurrency has been raised regularly, and we've chosen to leave it outside of our risk appetite at this stage. Where we do have interest is certainly on central bank digital currencies, and I think we'll come on to discuss that a little bit later. But when it comes to crypto, what I'm minded of is the journey that payment companies have been on for the last 3 or 4 years. If I think to the fintech payment companies that we have as clients, today they do a sterling job of maintaining very high KYC, AML and CFT standards. And that all wasn't always true of the fintech payment industry. A few years ago, we certainly saw far more potential clients struggle to get through our enhanced due diligence process. And I feel like the kind of crypto world is now going through probably some of the same regulatory pain points, some of those growing pains that you feel in the industry. So, you know, I suppose the 2 points I would make about that is, one, crypto remains outside of our risk appetite today, but that hopefully the crypto industry goes on the same regulatory journey and compliance journey that the more traditional payment industry has been on over the course of the last few years, and we'll see a tightening of those KYC, AML and CFT controls to move the industry into such a space that it becomes more readily bankable. That said, I suppose the final bit I'll touch on is to echo what Mitch has said, in that, you know, sometimes we are the master of our own destiny, and other times we have to work collaboratively as an industry, as a network of correspondence. So we know that banks, or correspondent banks, particularly in the large OECD markets, have zero appetite for cryptocurrency today. And even if we chose to push the boundaries on our own appetite, we know that has ramifications when it comes to our own correspondence. And often the traditional classic payment business we do with those correspondents is fundamental to our business model, and we wouldn't wish to upset any of the compliance functions within those relationships. So it's a difficult tightrope to walk, but one that I feel is, you know, hopefully moving in the right direction. And actually, I think the stance taken by the FCA is probably one of the first moves made by a gold standard regulator globally to ensure that the crypto industry moves along that same journey that the payment industry has been on for the last few years. I'll pause there.
Mitch, did you want to come in there?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I think what's really important as well, just to call out, because Stephen and I, you know, we gave that overview of what we're both seeing. But a key part here is when we're talking about banks and the engagement with crypto, we're not talking about the custody wallet or holding the coin or anything like that. We're only at this stage just talking about the initial parts. A person wants to send money to a crypto firm, or the crypto firm has moved it back into fiat and exchanged it, and the person wants to receive money from a crypto firm. So as banks supporting other players, exchanges or other PSPs doing that, that's what we're talking about. And that's an interesting part of the risk appetite. It's who and which correspondent banks in the network are willing to engage in just that piece of the jigsaw. Are they willing to take money from the remitter in sterling, dollar, euro, whatever it might be, and remit it to the crypto firm? You're not at any point actually getting involved in the coin. All you're doing is giving money from A to B, which you know is for a virtual asset. And that's where the correspondent banking network is starting to look at what is their true appetite. And many firms have no appetite for that at all. And if you consider it, they're still not touching virtual assets. All they're doing is moving fiat from A to B, and then indeed from B back to A if someone decides to liquidate that position. And that's where this risk, source of wealth, et cetera, that's where people are now looking at what's actually happening and what's going on and developing their appetites. I just wanted to frame that as I look across to my colleagues.
Mitch is back here. I think that's a really good point. And I think there's kind of a broader point here, you know, particularly for payment service providers, which is even if you're not the one doing any of these regulated activities or you're not within this registration regime, do you need to be looking at this from the perspective of doing due diligence on your customers or on your partners? Because as we know, there's a lot of partnerships in the payment sector. You know, are there risks for your firm indirectly or maybe even directly if someone you're working with is in this space and they're not following the rules? That's kind of a big one. I don't have the answer to that. And I don't think the regulators have really, you know, worked through that, but that's a big open question.
I mean, that's a podcast on its own about where does financial crime liability start and end as one firm provides services to another. Maybe, Alison, we've already got our next topic.
Sounds good. Sounds important. And it also lends itself to the point about there's a divergence of approach here in terms of the UK now out of the EA can take a different route in regulation. There's clearly all those parties involved in this chain want the approval and comfort of going where everybody's going together. They want to see that somebody is authorised. They want to see that there's been some scrutiny done, that helps in the overall framework. But I know from having worked at the regulator and being closely involved over the past however many years, the regulator doesn't want to lend its credibility and name to something that it doesn't have to, doesn't want to, doesn't need to, because as soon as because that then may start encouraging consumers to access crypto, access the assets in a way which is more speculative and more risky, and it becomes a sort of self-fulfilling cycle. But there is consumer demand and there is interest. And back to the question, the UK is not able to diverge from the EA. Max, perhaps you would explain to us how that divergence is happening.
I'll try. So this is one I get asked about quite a lot. Let's start with the UK and then I'll kind of come on to the EU and how things may diverge. And by the way, I think they will diverge, and I'll tell you why in a bit. So as I mentioned, Treasury, UK Treasury's run two public consultations looking at reforms in this area. One is on extending restrictions on financial promotion, so that's rules about marketing, to cover a broader range of crypto assets. Now, those rules currently apply to certain regulated crypto assets, the ones I was talking about earlier. They want to extend that. And basically, again, they're thinking of extending that to a range of crypto assets that are both fungible and transferable. So that's one thing. The other thing, which kind of comes to these authorization requirements we were talking about earlier, which is separate from the AML registration, is to include, I sort of mentioned this briefly earlier, to include stable coins or tokens, stable tokens within those authorization requirements, to bring those within scope of what we call the regulatory perimeter. Now, I don't think I've explained what stablecoins tokens are. Some people really know exactly what those are. I'll attempt a definition, or at least how the UK government's thinking about it. We're talking here about instruments, tokens, the value of which is linked to one or more fiat currencies, the traditional currencies, or backed by other assets like money market funds or gold, with the aim of those tokens having a stable value, hence the name stablecoin. And the idea in the UK is really to focus, at least initially, the regulatory efforts, the regulatory reforms, on crypto assets that are most likely to be used as a substitute for money. That's the focus. In the EU, the European Commission has proposed a new EU regulation on crypto assets, which is called the Markets in Crypto Assets Regulation, or the MiCA regulation. And that could be in effect, it's still being negotiated within the EU legislative framework, but it could be in effect by as early as 2023. And it's got some similarities to the UK proposals. It covers things like authorization, conduct of business, disclosures, reporting, prudential requirements. But the big difference, as I see it anyway, is the scope is much, much broader. The proposed EU regime would cover most forms of digital tokens and crypto assets that are not currently regulated under EU law and are not currently regulated in the UK. So whereas the UK is taking, a slightly more iterative approach, focusing on stable coins first, looking at things like systemic risk, what does this mean for the broader economy, for the financial system? And it's probably giving a lot more, it's probably going to give a lot more discretion to regulators like the Financial Conduct Authority, the Prudential Regulation Authority, the Bank of England, and the Payment Systems Regulator to set their own rules and guidance under a broad statutory framework, rather than to bake the rules into the legislation, which is, what the EU seems to be doing with some of the rules in the MiCA regulation. So in theory, at least I think this is the idea, that could give the UK a bit more flexibility to adapt to market changes, to adapt to the risks, to see what happens in the EU and what other regulators around the world do. But again, remains to be seen how that's all going to turn out.
Thanks, Max. Stephen, do you have any views on the regulation?
I mean, nowhere near as detailed as Mike, which is understandable. I think if there's going to be a divergence, it seems likely the UK is, very much trying to carve out a position for itself, maintaining a position as a global powerhouse in financial services post Brexit. And the crypto is clearly a very important topic in that space. I think the question for me, though, for the regulator, we clearly can't answer this here, but maintaining very high standards of supervision in the financial services sector is a prerequisite to the UK being a gold standard and having a UK license being an important badge of honour for entities when they're trading internationally. And the counterpoint to that is how do you maintain innovation in financial services whilst maintaining extremely high standards of supervision and regulation? And I don't know the answer to that question because, clearly one of the most attractive features of crypto and of fintech in general, of course, has been that disruptive nature to the financial services industry. And what we're seeing now, of course, is that there's those barriers to entry that Mitch touched upon earlier. Maintaining and creating high barriers to entry is not conducive when it comes to innovation. So I don't know the answer to that. I don't know how the regulator is going to play that out in the coming weeks, months and years, but clearly there's a balance to be maintained between keeping a gold standard when it comes to regulation, but also inviting innovation from within the financial services sector. That's a tricky balance to match.
And perhaps one of the reasons why the registration regime has fallen into complexities as it stands, when you're bringing people who are disruptors or innovators, but not necessarily from a financial services background, it can be difficult to understand how financial service regulation works and to be able to fit into the right patterns in order to proceed through the expectations. We were mentioning stablecoins and the ratings agency Fitch has added its voice to concerns regarding stablecoins, saying that it actually can trigger a credit market contagion. And it would be great to talk a little bit more about stablecoins and why they might not be quite as stable as the name suggests. Max?
Yeah, so this is an interesting one. And I think the concern here is sort of linked to what I was saying earlier about what stablecoins are. They can be linked to a specific currency, but they can also be backed by other assets. Now, ideally, you'd have other assets that are, as the name suggests, very stable. So you could peg the value and that wouldn't move. But I think what Fitch has been saying, at least what they're reporting, is that they're seeing, some of these so-called stable tokens actually being linked to less liquid assets or assets that are, debt. And therefore, there could be risks around, like, what if there are suddenly a load of redemptions on this kind of token? Is that going to cause a run? Is that going to cause the value to fluctuate? So there's some big questions here, which I think the regulation in this area is going to need to answer, which is if we're regulating stable coins as a separate category of instrument, what kind of rules are we expecting around what those assets comprise and the quality of them and the liquidity of them? So it's an interesting point.
Thank you, Max. And is the answer to the difficulties of stablecoin the issuance of digital currencies by central banks? Stephen?
Excellent question. I think it's difficult to answer in that we're not quite sure what central bank digital currencies are looking to achieve. Stablecoin, in essence, gives that assurance to the consumer and to the industry that there is going to be stability, as the name suggests. But clearly, a central bank digital currency is one step further. And I think in many instances, I think central banks actually will look for a central bank digital currency to be that answer, that counterpoint to stable coins. One of the things that I think has been challenging for central banks has been, what role do they want a central bank digital currency to fulfil, and how is that relevant in different countries? You know, we often hear financial inclusion being highlighted as a primary responsibility for a central bank digital currency. Clearly, that seems very relevant in markets where financial inclusion is not far-reaching. So we know that there are many of the emerging and frontier markets where financial inclusion is still very much a challenge. But how is that? That's a very different situation from what we have in the UK, where financial inclusion is much more widespread. So, you know, understanding exactly what a central bank wishes to achieve with the digital currency will go a long way to answering the question, is it the solution to stablecoin? Because, you know, we work with, in fact, we bank a lot of central banks around the world. Every one of them has got a viewpoint on central bank digital currencies, but very rarely is it the same viewpoint. You know, typically what we find is they've all got a slightly different take, and that's to be expected because every country is different. The situation they're trying to manage is different. You know, so I can give an example. We know that some central banks are extraordinarily keen to use this to broaden financial inclusion and also to encourage remittances into the country. Many countries, as I'm sure many listeners will be aware, they're very reliant upon remittances as part of their GDP. Now, if you want to encourage that type of cross-border remittance in a digital currency, not only do you need your own digital currency, but most likely you need to be able to link that to another country's digital currency as well. And suddenly the complexity becomes, you know, multiple folds what it is when you start looking at a sole country. So I suppose in essence, is a central bank digital currency the answer? I suppose we don't know until we fully know what the question is. And I think until we know exactly what the question is, it's difficult to know what the answer will be. But I do think both stable coins and central bank digital currencies will both be part of the solution as we look to include crypto assets and cryptocurrencies as part of the broader financial services sector. So, but I'll pause there to see if my colleagues have got any further thoughts or comments.
Thanks, Stephen. It's Max. I mean, I agree with everything you said there. I think that's a really good summary. And you can kind of see from the Bank of England's, you know, the fact that these are discussion papers. They're not consultations. They're not a set of specific reforms. They are kind of broad. Here's what we want to do. Here's how we think it might help. But, you know, we have opened this to discussion. So I think there's actually a big opportunity for payments firms, one, to get involved in the debate around if, you know, should there be a central bank digital currency in the UK? If so, what should it look like? How should it be structured? What are the rules around its operation? How do we make sure that all players in the market, you know, that should have access to that do have access to it? And I also think there's potentially quite a big opportunity here for payment service providers, because one of the things that the Bank of England's talked about is, should we have a central bank digital currency that's based on what they're calling a platform model, where you would have, you know, it's still a direct liability of the central bank, like a coin or a banknote, but you'd have players, you'd have sort of private players potentially involved in operating wallets to help sort of intermediate between the Bank of England and the end users. Now, I think that could potentially be a very interesting area for a lot of the market to think about.
Yeah, totally agree, Max. And I think you touched on it at the end. For me, what's most exciting about these central bank digital currencies is that coin and cash replacement piece. So we take it all the way back. E-money with these firms, it's still kind of what it's known as private money, right? It's locked, it's that. Whereas physical cash and coin is public. CBDCs is the Bank of England's form of public digital money, and how that will then change people's attitudes towards cash and what will happen as a result of that, I find super interesting. And then the part of the intermediation that you mentioned about who will help with the wallets, et cetera, that's the role currently of banks and PSPs, et cetera. But if the Bank of England's starting to look at that, and if they actually have the technology or have third-party tech providers helping provide wallets that they then provide directly to the public, well, what becomes the role of banks and PSPs and everything else in this? I find the whole change super interesting and look forward to seeing where it all lands. But that, for me, is the key part. A central bank acting as a way with third-party tech to have a wallet, to offer public money in a digital form. What does that mean for the entire system?
We're going to leave on that fundamental sort of identity crisis kind of question. As you can see, this is a massive subject. I'm delighted that our panelists have joined us for a really great and interesting discussion and plenty of insight. The key takeaways for me are about the AML registration. Don't be confused with authorization. It doesn't mean that you can do regulated activities. It just means that you're getting supervised for anti-money laundering. UK is diverging from the EA in approach to crypto regulation. The scope of MiCA will cover most forms of crypto assets, whereas the UK is looking at creating a framework that enables the FCA and others to develop rules iteratively and according to risks as they arise. And crypto and stablecoin, it's part of the answer, but the question's still probably to be confirmed. And there's plenty of opportunity for emerging payments members to join the discussion. Thank you to our amazing panelists, Max Savoy, Steve Mitchell, and Mitch Trahan. If you want to find out more about the EPA or project regulator, please do get in touch. And all our panelists can be contacted via LinkedIn or through the EPA. Thank you very much, everybody.